the whole party. That's the Republican Party in 1956. 60 years later, the platform is just the opposite. They are opposed to a minimum wage. They are opposed to they don't have a problem with unions per se, although what they're apparently trying to do, and Republican governors have done in several states, passing right-to-work legislation, is they're trying to weaken the ability of unions to do what they're there for, which is to represent workers.
And so, that's, we're here for the union voice or the working people's voice, so stay tuned every Monday from 6 to 6:30 for the Labor Radio Show. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, callers. Get those ballots in.
Yep.
My 19-year-old grandson voted a few days ago, and he said it made him feel like a citizen.
All right. So. Okay. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week. Bye bye.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, a series at Northwest Film Center through November 1st. Tackling wide-ranging, thought-provoking issues, activist filmmakers deepen our awareness of injustice and the values of dignity and equality as they tell universal stories of struggle and triumph. Films to be shown include The Crossing, an account of Syrian refugees on October 28th, and The Road, about the Chinese government building a superhighway through Hunan Province. That screens on November 1st. Again, it's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, playing at Northwest Film Center in Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
November 11th is Veterans Day, a day to honor those men and women who served in the United States Armed Forces. But our veterans are also serving time in our jails and prisons, and Oregon has among the highest rate of incarcerated veterans in the nation. Join Prison Pipeline on November 7th as we discuss why so many of our men and women in uniform end up in the criminal justice system. That's Prison Pipeline, November 7th at 6:30 p.m.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight, I'm speaking with Alice Lindell and Julia Yoshimoto from the Oregon Justice Resource Center about their report, An Alternative to Women's Prison Expansion in Oregon, which was produced by the Oregon Justice Resource Center's Women in Prison Project. Julia is the director of the Women in Prison Project, as well as a social worker and lawyer. Alice is the director of communications of the Oregon Justice Resource Center, and her background is in journalism. Currently, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility is the only women's prison in Oregon, and it is beyond the capacity and threshold set by the Department of Corrections to open another women's prison in Oregon. Julia and Alice join me to talk about the ways we might prevent having to open a second women's prison in Oregon.
So to give you a bit of background on the situation we're in now, women are still, even today, a small proportion of the number of people that we lock up in Oregon. It's the same as in other states. Most of the people in our prisons are men. But that kind of maybe obscures a little bit what's happened to the women's population in the last 20 years. Because actually the rate of female incarceration in Oregon has tripled in the last two decades. And that is a much faster rate of growth than the rate of growth among the men. So although there are still more men in prison in Oregon than there are women, the growth in the women's population has been pretty explosive. And we are forecast to add even more women to that population over the next 10 years. And we really think as an organization that we need to be taking a close look at how many women we're incarcerating and why we're doing that. And now is a really good time to look at that issue because, as you said, we are facing this situation where Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which is currently our only women's prison in Oregon, is beyond capacity and has been so for some time. And so something has to be done about the overcrowding. The Department of Corrections is understandably trying to find a solution because overcrowding is bad for the inmates and it's bad for the staff. So it's right that they're trying to do something about it. But the suggested answer to the situation that we will be facing if things don't change, if the numbers don't drop, is to open this second unit at Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem, which would also house women. And we're pretty concerned about that because we think not only is there a massive cost involved, we're talking about millions of dollars to open the prison, to staff it, and to keep it open for we don't know how long. But also, once you expand the capacity for incarcerating women, we're concerned that that kind of becomes the new normal. Once you have this larger capacity, there's always in any system, like there's a temptation to fill up the capacity you have. And you have this possibility that people in the system will be thinking, oh, we've got more space now. So if I want to send somebody to prison, I'm going to have room to do so. So we think it's really important right now to look at some ways that we can cut the numbers of women in prison enough to deal with this immediate problem of overcrowding. And then from that, we need to look at the system as a whole and reduce the drivers behind this growth in the women's prison population.
What are the drivers? Do we know why so many more women are now being incarcerated in Oregon and why the rate went up?
It's not really clear why the rates have risen to this degree. What we do know is that women tend to commit property and drug offenses. Identity theft and theft are the top two crimes that women are convicted of. We know that there's a repeat property offender statute that Oregon has in which the sentences were increased for individuals who commit repeat property offenses, and it was increased through Measure 57. And we see sort of an uptick in the incarceration rates of women with Measure 57. But the women's population is not a population that's really been looked at. And so I think that there are a lot of different drivers. Women are different from men in terms of the way that they intersect with the criminal justice system, the types of crimes that they commit. And so that's one of the reasons that we have the Women in Prison Project, is that we need to find out more about what's going on with women in Oregon and the criminal justice system.
One thing I think is important on that note is that even as we've seen this tripling in the last 20 years, women's arrest rates are down. So it isn't just a simple answer of women are committing three times as much crime, so the incarceration rate triples. That is not the reason, because the arrest rate is down. And generally, the trend of crime is down over the last 20 years in Portland. So there is something else going on that we need to know more about.
What are some of the things we know about why women are intersecting with the criminal justice system in a different way than men are?
Well, so it's not a simple situation for anybody who ends up intersecting with the justice system. And of course, with all of this, there's always the issue of accountability of people for the things that they've done and people taking personal responsibility. But we do know with women that there's research out there on some of the things that are creating situations where women might get involved with behaviors that are likely to lead to incarceration. So things like homelessness, things like drug addiction, things like poverty, you know, some of these social problems that are providing a baseline of just a challenging situation that women can be in that can drive them towards, as I say, behaviors that could be criminal, that could lead them to incarceration. And also things like relationships. Crime that arises out of relationships, which could be, for example, an abusive relationship where somebody is either directly coerced into committing crime or is put in positions maybe through things like financial abuse where they might not feel there's much alternative, even if they're not being actually directly forced to participate in crime.
What are we facing right now? Could you explain a little bit more about what exactly the head of Coffee Creek is looking for and when a possible vote would be on the expansion of the prison, just to give a thought of when this might happen, and then we can talk about ways that we can work on preventing.
So in September, they were going to go to the emergency board and then...
What has happened right now is the Department of Corrections hasn't actually asked for the money to go ahead and open the second unit. And they would need money. They don't have capacity in their budgets. They would need to get funding from the legislature if they want to do it. They haven't actually asked for the money yet, but they have said very publicly, and it's obvious just from the numbers, that they are beyond the capacity of the women's prison. It's not a situation that can continue. And they basically put everyone kind of on notice, like, this is a big problem that we're going to have to deal with. There's not particularly any concrete reason why the numbers would be likely to drop back right now that would prevent having to go and ask for the money maybe as early as December. But they are giving a little more time to allow, just to give it a last chance, really, to try and see if some of the programs that provide alternatives to incarceration can do enough to kind of cut the numbers a little bit, just to stave off having to spend this money. Because I don't think anyone wants to open a second women's prison, but at the same time, you can't expect either the women in the prison or the staff working in the prison to deal with the conditions of overcrowding and the problems that that creates on a long-term basis. So we do have to find a way to address this.
So the build capacity is 4,253 women, I believe, and they've had to add an additional 100 or so beds, what they call like temporary and emergency beds, in order to take in more women. And so right now what they're looking at is that sort of the threshold number. If Coffee Creek's bed count stays over 1,280 beds consistently over a number of months, that's going to push them to have to go to the legislature to ask for more money to open up a second women's prison.
Mm-hmm. And so it means they have to find places to put extra beds, like double up and use spaces that aren't meant to be sleeping spaces as sleeping spaces. So then you're potentially taking away space that should be used for other activities like recreational or programming activities, because you have to find room to house people. And you also have to retain some spare capacity in the system. So you can't operate with every single bed full in reality, because people get moved around in the system and things come up and you need to find more space on sometimes short notice. So you actually have to build in a certain amount of empty space because of situations that can come up at any time. So they can't really actually operate with a totally full space, because then they could very quickly run into, you know, a crisis of where to put people.
How far are we from the crisis? Do we know, or are they kind of in the crisis?
We're in it, really. In it. I mean, yeah, in reality, like the 1280 capacity, well, the 1253 capacity, 1280 being the threshold to open a second unit. And as of the start of October, we're at 1300. So we were at 1305 in September. So we're at the crisis. But what we need is to do something about it.
I'd love to hear what the alternatives are.
So in looking at what we can do sort of in the short term around this issue, we had to look at what are the ways in which women are coming into prison and what are the ways in which women can be released from prison. So the six solutions that we put together looks at those various options. And the other thing that we looked at with the solutions are, who are the stakeholders in the system that can possibly more quickly create change than maybe moving something through the legislature? So our six solutions look at different stakeholders and people in positions of power that can affect the number of women going into the prison and the number of women being released from Coffee Creek. So the first solution that we talk about is the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program. And this is an alternative sentencing program that was passed by the legislature in 2015. And this is a program that is based off of a Washington State alternative sentencing program that passed in 2010 that is shown to have positive outcomes. And with the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, what it does is it looks at parents who have custody of their children or who are involved in their children's lives that are being charged with crimes and fit certain criteria, that instead of being sentenced to a term of prison, they'll be sentenced to sort of heavier probation that's focused around parenting and providing the individual with wraparound services that they need to help them be successful in the community and to stay a part of their family's lives. And so this was a program passed in 2015. It's still fairly new. It started in January of this year. What we have heard from DOC is that there are some pieces of the statute or of the bill as it was passed that create barriers for individuals who might be really good for this program from getting into the program. So one of the things that we recommend is that there be legislative fixes that DOC is recommending, and we would support those legislative fixes. The other thing that we've heard is that criminal defense attorneys, judges, people in the judiciary aren't very aware of this family sentencing alternative pilot program. And so what we want to do is increase awareness by defense attorneys so that they can advocate for their clients to be put into this program. It's piloted in 5 counties. So it's piloted in Marion County, Washington and Multnomah, Jackson County and Deschutes County. And so what we have done recently is to have a continuing learning education program where we're educating criminal defense attorneys about the Family Sentencing Alternative Program.
Let's talk about the specific things that you have proposed for changing the Family Sentencing Alternative Project.
So these are all recommendations that are coming from DOC, and DOC is a big partner in implementation of this program along mm-hmm. with DHS. What they were finding is one of the restrictions is if you have a person felony somewhere in your background that you are then ineligible for this program. So there are individuals who might be a good fit for remaining in the community, improving their parenting skills, staying a part of their children's lives. But because somewhere in their past they have, say, a lower level robbery or something that's considered a person crime, they're considered ineligible for this program.
What is a person crime?
Person crimes are crimes like assault or with robbery an individual is involved.
Where there's like a person victim who's right there being affected yeah. by the crime, as opposed yeah. to, say, a theft where, yeah, a person might be affected, but, like, it's not happening. Like, it's not like someone comes up and attacks you to get your money. Mm-hmm. Like, it's someone takes something when you're not there or something.
One of the issues that came up, according to the language, you needed to have custody of a child. And so women who are pregnant didn't yet have custody of a child.
Yeah.
And so they want to change the language to include women who are pregnant. And that would be a good fit for this program to be eligible. The second thing that we were looking at are executive clemency. So it's the power of the governor to look at specific individuals and reduce their sentences. The governor has the power to look at individuals that maybe have spent enough time in prison, have been held accountable long enough, that have rehabilitated, that no longer pose a threat to public safety for them to be released, maybe even serves the public better for them to be out of prison. But because of the term that they were sentenced to, they are still there in Coffee Creek. And the governor has the clemency power to look at an individual situation and reduce their sentences. So what we're suggesting in this solution is that maybe there are certain individuals, for example, a woman whose commission of her crime is out of an interpersonal violence relationship or domestic violence type of relationship. She's already served a significant amount of time. Perhaps this is the only crime that she's ever committed, has gone through a lot of programming in Coffee Creek, and really is no longer can be considered a public safety threat if she were released.
You're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We're discussing the Oregon Justice Resource Center's report, An Alternative to Women's Prison Expansion in Oregon.
The third solution that we proposed is there's a statute under which the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision can grant the early release of individuals who are considered severely or terminally ill or who are permanently incapacitated or elderly inmates where the continuation of them to be in prison is considered cruel and inhumane. And maybe it's in the best interest of society and that individual that they be released early. So What we want to do is look at the population that we have now. Are there women in there that would fall under this category? And, you know, are there advocates out there to help the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision to make this decision for early release? So the clemency petitions, individuals can apply by themselves. Actually, in both situations, individuals can make this request on their own. I think that the expertise and the understanding that attorneys have about how these processes work is very helpful in terms of putting the story together in a way that is compelling and persuasive. When it comes to the issue of terminally ill or permanently incapacitated, it's the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision that ultimately makes that decision. But advocates, individuals in the community, they can be the one to bring it to the attention of the board and to make that request on behalf of an inmate who might not be able to do so. The next solution that we address is this issue of probation violations and probation revocations. So if you are sentenced to probation, but for various reasons have violated the terms of your probation, your probation can be revoked and the consequence can be that you are incarcerated. What we have heard is that community corrections and the probation officers are trying their best that if individuals are violating terms of their probation, that they're working with them to have sort of more community sanctions or sanctions that keep people in the community. Mm-hmm. But we have heard that there are situations in which individuals are revoked on their probation and are returning to prison. And so what we're suggesting is that the solution is that incarceration be the last consequence of having violated your probation and that all other possible community sanctions be looked at first.
Well, that would definitely go a long way to help us out. So let's see. Other ones are expanding access to transitional leave and alternative incarceration programs. Could you explain what those are?
Mm-hmm. So transitional leave or short-term transitional leave is a period of time in which an individual is still serving their sentence under Department of Corrections, but they are actually serving it out of prison. So they're in the community on this short-term transitional leave. And transitional leave used to be 30 days. And in 2013, with the passage of House Bill 3194, it was expanded to 90 days transitional leave. And what they're finding is that this is helping to relieve the bed space and relieve the number of individuals that are incarcerated. And they're also finding that individuals are doing well on the short-term transitional leave, and they're doing well in the community. So one of the things that we're looking at is, can we increase short-term transitional leave to maybe 120 days or something that's a little longer? Because if we are releasing women a little earlier, then we're opening up more bed space. The other program that we're looking at is the alternative incarceration programs. And those are cognitive behavioral therapy-based programs that are in the prisons. In Coffee Creek, from my understanding, there's a cognitive behavioral therapy program, and then there's also one that has a drug treatment or addiction piece to it. And these are programs that tend to be about 6 months long. And when women complete these programs, they are then have a out-of-prison community piece to it, that they are then transitioned out of prison. Their sentence time or the time that they're serving can be reduced greatly. And so what I hear from the women that I work with is that they want to be in these programs. They want to receive this treatment, this behavioral therapy, but there's not enough space for them to participate in these alternative incarceration programs. Yeah. So if we could expand the number of individuals that can access the program, more individuals would be completing the program and be able to be released earlier.
What's the last solution you guys have proposed?
So there are a few women that are potentially eligible for parole. So most individuals now, when they're convicted of crimes and sentenced to prison, they're sentenced for a determinate sentence. And so they're not going before the parole board to determine when their release date will be. But there are some women who do, because of the crimes that they committed or when they committed their crimes, will still be going before the parole board for their release dates. So what we're suggesting is that we identify who those women are and help the women to prepare their case before the parole board. If they've dramatically rehabilitated, if they are going to be safe out in the community, that we help them to present their case to the parole board for that release date.
And if we change the laws in Oregon, like Measure 11 and other ones have mandatory minimum sentences, would that do a lot to reduce the prison population?
Repealing mandatory minimum sentences would potentially help to alleviate the number of individuals incarcerated for such long sentences. The other thing to keep in mind when it comes to mandatory minimums is that the way that they're used in charging practices. So the other way that it results in sort of longer sentences is that if you are charged with, say, 5 mandatory minimum sentences, that means if you go to trial, you're looking at a long prison sentence. And if that's sort of hanging over your head when you're looking at your plea agreement, you're more likely to be pleading to a longer sentence because of those mandatory minimum charges that you're facing.
But when it comes to people's, you know, people are thinking about, do I plead guilty? Do I come to a deal now with the prosecutor or do I go to trial? Well, you know, almost no one goes to trial, and there's a good reason for that, because people are terrified by the prospect and they don't know what would have happened, you know, but they're terrified by this prospect. If I go to trial, I risk this gigantic long sentence and I can't take that risk. So I'm going to do a deal, and maybe that deal isn't as good because the prosecutor might know I'm more likely to agree to it anyway because I have this much worse possibility hanging over me if I go to trial. So I will accept a less attractive plea agreement because I don't want the even worse option of what could happen at trial.
Yeah, and isn't it something like 70%
or way high?
95% of
criminal cases.
Cases they end.
Almost no one goes to trial. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
If everyone went to trial tomorrow, the system would collapse.
Yeah.
Some people might say that was a good thing, but it wouldn't work. There isn't capacity to manage all of these cases through the court system. Mm. And for the moment, with the system we have, people aren't making the choice to go to trial for the reason we just discussed, you know, that it's a big risk for people. If they lose, they really, really, really pay for it. So not many people want to do that.
So who are the key players that can help us get this all brought together?
In our solutions, we look at stakeholders that are also outside of the legislature. So with the executive clemency, a key stakeholder there is the governor. With the issue of the severely or terminally ill individuals, it's the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision. When it comes to probation violations and revocation of probations, we're talking about community corrections agencies, POs, prosecutors. Eligibility for parole, again, is the Board of Parole and post-prison supervision. And so what we want to do is help to identify that there are other stakeholders in the community that have the power to make change. And a lot of focus is placed on the legislature because a lot of big movement can be made there. But we should not ignore the fact that there are other individuals that can create change in the system.
And one of the most important is the district attorneys as well. We talked about charging practices and how that is influencing the kind of sentences people are getting. District attorneys have a tremendous amount of power in our justice system because they make a decision that's not reviewable on if they're going to charge somebody with a crime and what they're going to charge them with. And because almost nobody goes to trial in the vast majority of cases, whatever sentence or punishment or, you know, penalty that person is going to have for their crime is going to be decided with the district attorney. So they are one of the most powerful actors in the justice system.
And can they be influenced by individuals listening?
District attorney is an elected position in the state. So yes, they very much can every time their term of office is up for election. But the reality is a lot of voters are not very engaged with the district attorney election. A lot of the time people don't get alternatives. They may well only have one candidate. Mm-hmm. The current DA will be the only candidate frequently. Mm-hmm. So you don't tend to get really competitive races where people are really being presented with a real choice, a meaningful choice. So I think definitely there's a wider issue there around getting more people to run for DA and getting more focus on the power that DAs have so that voters understand that the decision they make, if they even do vote in this race, which many people don't, is an extremely important one that will have far-reaching consequences for everyone who comes into contact with our justice system, and for all of us, even for those of us who don't come into contact with the justice system, if you're paying taxes, you are helping to pay for that system. So it should matter a lot to all of us who our DAs are. Ultimately, when people run for election, that's partly comes down to their personal choice, but I think also empowering people who might be suitable candidates to feel like they can do it, and like there is interest out there in the community and support out there in the community for just different ideas coming through and different approaches maybe, or at least providing alternatives as a choice for voters, I think is really important. In if you're going to have a really vibrant democracy, you want voters to have choice. What this all kind of leads to is we have our six solutions, and we do think that these really can have a short-term impact that will cut the numbers. You know, if we use all of them, each one cuts a few from the prison population and does enough to hold off on opening a second unit for now. But ultimately, what we need is some real change in the system. We need to look at how many people we're locking up and why, what we think we're achieving, and are we really achieving that goal? If we're locking up three times as many women as we did 20 years ago, has that made us safer? Has that made people more accountable for their actions? Is it having to rehabilitate more people? And if it's not, then we should be looking at maybe what we could do instead.
But the six solutions also address issues that could be foundational or starting point for longer term solutions. Like the Family Sentencing Alternative Pilot Program, we're looking at alternatives to incarceration. And that is a difficult conversation that we're going to start having, is if we're really going to move for reform, what is it that we're going to do as a community instead of incarcerating individuals? It also looks at individualized situations of defendants, looking at what their place is in the community as a parent. So with each of these solutions, if we start doing a deeper dive into the issues that it brings up, I think that's where we start those conversations for longer term solutions.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. I want to thank my guests, Alice Lindell and Julia Yoshimoto of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. Find their report on ojrc.org on the Women in Prison Project tab under What We Do. Thank you to our engineer, Danielle Parks. Good night.
November 11th is